Lord Arthur Savile's Crime by Oscar Wilde. Chapter 1. It was Lady Windermere's last reception before Easter, and Bentinck House was even more crowded than usual. 6 cabinet ministers had come on from the speaker's levee in their stars and ribbons. All the pretty women wore their smartest dresses, and at the end of the picture gallery stood the Princess Sophia of Karlsruhe, a heavy tartar-looking lady with tiny black eyes and wonderful emeralds, talking bad French at the top of her voice and laughing immoderately at everything that was said to her. It was certainly a wonderful medley of people. Gorgeous peeresses chatted affably to violent radicals. Popular preachers brushed coattails with eminent skeptics. A perfect bevy of bishops kept following a stout prima donna from room to room. On the staircase stood several royal academicians disguised as artists, and it was said that at one time the supper-room was absolutely crammed with geniuses. In fact, it was one of Lady Windermere's best nights, and the princess stayed till nearly 11:30. As soon as she had gone, Lady Windermere returned to the picture gallery, where a celebrated political economist was solemnly explaining the scientific theory of music to an indignant virtuoso from Hungary, and began to talk to the Duchess of Paisley. She looked wonderfully beautiful with her grand ivory throat, her large blue forget-me-not eyes, and her heavy coils of golden hair. Are pure they were, not that pale straw color that nowadays usurps the gracious name of gold, but such gold as is woven into sunbeams or hidden in strange amber, and they gave to her face something of the frame of a saint, with not a little of the fascination of a sinner. She was a curious psychological study. Early in life she had discovered the important truth that nothing looks so like innocence as an indiscretion, and by a series of reckless escapades, half of them quite harmless, she had acquired all the privileges of a personality. She had more than once changed her husband. Indeed, Deborah credits her with 3 marriages. But as she had never changed her lover, the world had long ago ceased to talk scandal about her. She was now 40 years of age, childless, and with that inordinate passion for pleasure which is the secret of remaining young. Suddenly she looked eagerly round the room and said in her clear contralto voice, "Where is my chiromantist?" "Your what, Gladys?" exclaimed the Duchess, giving an involuntary start. "My chiromantist, Duchess. I can't live without him at present." "Dear Gladys, you're always so original," murmured the Duchess, trying to remember what a chiromantist really was, and hoping it was not the same as a chiropodist. "He comes to see my hand 2 a week regularly," continued Lady Windermere, "and is most interesting about it." "Good heavens," said the Duchess to herself, "he is a sort of chiropodist after all. How very dreadful. I hope he is a foreigner at any rate. It wouldn't be quite so bad, then." "I must certainly introduce him to you." "Introduce him?" cried the Duchess. "You don't mean to say he is here?" And she began looking about for a small tortoise-shell fan and a very tattered lace shawl, so as to be ready to go at a moment's notice. "Of course he is here. I would not dream of giving a party without him. He tells me I have a pure psychic hand, and that if my thumb had been the least little bit shorter, I should have been a confirmed pessimist and gone into a convent." "Oh, I see," said the Duchess, feeling very much relieved. "He tells fortunes, I suppose." "And misfortunes, too," answered Lady Windermere. "Any amount of them. Next year, for instance, I am in great danger both by land and sea, so I am going to live in a balloon and draw up my dinner in a basket every evening. It's all written down on my little finger, or on the palm of my hand, I forget which. But surely that is tempting Providence, Gladys. My dear Duchess, surely Providence can resist temptation by this time. I think everyone should have their hands told once a month so as to know what not to do. Of course, one does it all the same, but it's so pleasant to be warned. Now, if someone doesn't go and fetch Mr. Podgers at once, I shall have to go myself. Let me go, Lady Windermere, said a tall, handsome young man who was standing by, listening to the conversation with an amused smile. Thank you so very much, Lord Arthur, but I'm afraid you wouldn't recognize him. If he's as wonderful as you say, Lady Windermere, I couldn't well miss him. Tell me what he's like, and I'll bring him to you at once. Well, he is not a bit like a chiromantist. I mean, he is not mysterious or esoteric or romantic-looking. He's a little stout man with a funny bald head and great gold-rimmed spectacles, something between a family doctor and a country attorney. I'm really very sorry, but it's not my fault. People are so annoying. All my pianists look exactly like poets, and all my poets look exactly like pianists. And I remember last season asking a most dreadful conspirator to dinner, a man who had blown up ever so many people, and always wore a coat of mail, and carried a dagger up his shirt sleeve. And do you know that when he came he looked just like a nice old clergyman and cracked jokes all the evening? Of course he was very amusing and all that, but I was terribly disappointed. And when I asked about the coat of mail, he only laughed and said it was far too cold to wear in England. Ah, here is Mr. Podgers. Now, Mr. Podgers, I want you to tell the Duchess of Paisley's hand. Duchess, you must take your glove off. No, not the left hand, the other. Dear Gladys, I really don't think it's quite right, said the Duchess, feebly unbuttoning a rather soiled kid glove. Nothing interesting ever is, said Lady Windermere. On a fait le monde ainsi. But I must introduce you, Duchess. This is Mr. Podgers, my pet chiromantist. Mr. Podgers, this is the Duchess of Paisley, and if you say she has a larger mountain of the moon than I have, I will never believe in you again. I'm sure, Gladys, there is nothing of the kind in my hand, said the Duchess gravely. Ah, your grace is quite right, said Mr. Podgers, glancing at the little fat hand with its short square fingers. The mountain of the moon is not developed. The line of life, however, is excellent. Kindly bend the wrist. Thank you. Three distinct lines on the rascette. You will live to a great age, Duchess, and be extremely happy. Ambition, very moderate. Line of intellect, not exaggerated. Line of heart. Now do be indiscreet, Mr. Podgers, cried Lady Windermere. Nothing would give me greater pleasure, said Mr. Podgers, bowing. If the Duchess ever had been, but I'm sorry to say that I see great permanence of affection combined with a strong sense of duty. Pray go on, Mr. Podgers, said the Duchess, looking quite pleased. Economy is not the least of your grace's virtues, continued Mr. Podgers, and Lady Windermere went off into fits of laughter. Economy is a very good thing, remarked the Duchess complacently. When I married Paisley, he had 11 castles and not a single house fit to live in. And now he has 12 houses and not a single castle, cried Lady Windermere. Well, my dear, said the Duchess, I like comfort, said Mr. Podgers, and modern improvements, and hot water laid on in every bedroom. Your grace is quite right. Comfort is the only thing our civilization can give us. You've told the Duchess's character admirably, Mr. Podgers, and now you must tell Lady Flora's. And in answer to a nod from the smiling hostess, a tall girl with sandy Scotch hair and high shoulder blades stepped awkwardly from behind the sofa and held out a long, bony hand with spatulate fingers. "Ah, pianist, I see," said Mr. Podgers, "an excellent pianist, but perhaps hardly a musician. Very reserved, very honest, and with a great love of animals." "Quite true," exclaimed the Duchess, turning to Lady Windermere, "absolutely true. Flora keeps 24 collie dogs at Makloski, and would turn our townhouse into a menagerie if her father would let her." "Well, that is just what I do with my house every Thursday evening," cried Lady Windermere, laughing. "Only I like lions better than collie dogs." "Your one mistake, Lady Windermere," said Mr. Podgers, with a pompous bow. "If a woman can't make her mistakes charming, she is only a female," was the answer. "But you must read some more hands for us. Come, Sir Thomas, show Mr. Podgers yours." And a genial-looking old gentleman in a white waistcoat came forward and held out a thick, rugged hand with a very long third finger. "An adventurous nature. 4 long voyages in the past and 1 to come. Been shipwrecked 3 times. No, only 2, but in danger of a shipwreck your next journey. Strong conservative, very punctual, and with a passion for collecting curiosities. Had a severe illness between the ages 16 and 17. Was left a fortune when about 30. Great aversion to cats and radicals." "Extraordinary!" exclaimed Sir Thomas. "You must really tell my wife's hand, too." "Your second wife's," said Mr. Podgers quietly, still keeping Sir Thomas's hand in his. "Your second wife's. I shall be charmed, but Lady Marvel, a melancholy-looking woman with brown hair and sentimental eyelashes, entirely declined to have her past or her future exposed, and nothing that Lady Windermere could do would induce Monsieur de Koloff, the Russian ambassador, even to take his gloves off. In fact, many people seemed afraid to face the odd little man with his stereotyped smile, his gold spectacles, and his bright, beady eyes, and when he told poor Lady Fermor right out before everyone that she did not care a bit for music, but was extremely fond of musicians, it was generally felt that chiromancy was a most dangerous science, and one that ought not to be encouraged except in a tête-à-tête. Lord Arthur Savile, however, who did not know anything about Lady Fermor's unfortunate story, and who had been watching Mr. Podgers with a great deal of interest, was filled with an immense curiosity to have his own hand read, and feeling something shy about putting himself forward, crossed over the room to where Lady Windermere was sitting, and with a charming blush asked her if she thought Mr. Podgers would mind. "Of course he won't mind," said Lady Windermere. "This is what he is here for. All my lions, Lord Arthur, are performing lions, and jump through hoops whenever I ask them. But I must warn you beforehand that I shall tell Sybil everything. She's coming to lunch with me tomorrow to talk about bonnets, and if Mr. Podgers finds out you have a bad temper, or a tendency to gout, or a wife living in Bayswater, I shall certainly let her know all about it." Lord Arthur smiled and shook his head. "I'm not afraid," he answered. "Sybil knows me as well as I know her." "Ah, I am a little sorry to hear you say that. The proper basis for marriage is a mutual misunderstanding. No, I'm not at all cynical. I have merely got experience, which, however, is very much the same thing. Mr. Podgers, Lord Arthur Savile is dying to have his hand read. Don't tell him that he is engaged to one of the most beautiful girls in London, because that appeared in the Morning Post a month ago." "Dear Lady Windermere," cried the Marchesa of Jedburgh, "do let Mr. Podgers stay a little longer. He has just told me I should go on stage, and I am so interested." "If he's told you that, Lady Jedburgh, I shall certainly take him away. Come here at once, Mr. Podgers, and read Lord Arthur's hand." "Well," said Lady Jedburgh, making a little moue as she rose from the sofa, If I'm not allowed to go on the stage, I must be allowed to be a part of the audience at any rate. Of course, we're all going to be part of the audience, said Lady Windermere. And now, Mr. Podgers, be sure and tell us something nice. Lord Arthur is one of my special favorites. But when Mr. Podgers saw Lord Arthur's hand, he grew curiously pale and said nothing. A shudder seemed to pass through him, and his great bushy eyebrows twitched convulsively in an odd, irritating way they had when he was puzzled. Then some huge beads of perspiration broke out on his yellow forehead like a poisonous dew, and his fat fingers grew cold and clammy. Lord Arthur did not fail to notice these strange signs of agitation, and for the first time in his life he himself felt fear. His impulse was to rush from the room, but he restrained himself. It was better to know the worst, whatever it was, than to be left in this hideous uncertainty. "I am waiting, Mr. Podgers," he said. "We are all waiting," cried Lady Windermere in her quick, impatient manner, but the chiromantist made no reply. "I believe Arthur is going on the stage," said Lady Jedburgh, "and that after your scolding, Mr. Podgers is afraid to tell him so." Suddenly Mr. Podgers dropped Lord Arthur's right hand and seized hold of his left, bending down so low to examine it that the gold rims of his spectacles seemed almost to touch the palm. For a moment his face became a white mask of horror, but he soon recovered his sang-froid and, looking up at Lady Windermere, said with a forced smile, "It is the hand of a charming young man." "Of course it is," answered Lady Windermere. "But will he be a charming husband? That's what I want to know." "All charming young men are," said Mr. Podgers. "I don't think a husband should be too fascinating," murmured Lady Jedburgh pensively. "It is so dangerous." "My dear child, they never are too fascinating," cried Lady Windermere. "But what I want are details. Details are the only things that interest. What is going to happen to Lord Arthur?" "Well, within the next few months, Lord Arthur will go a voyage." "Oh, yes, his honeymoon, of course." "And lose a relative." "Not his sister, I hope," said Lady Jedburgh in a piteous tone of voice. "Certainly not his sister," answered Mr. Podgers with a deprecating wave of the hand. "A distant relative, merely." "Well, I am dreadfully disappointed," said Lady Windermere. "I have absolutely nothing to tell Sybil tomorrow. No one cares about distant relatives nowadays. They went out of fashion years ago. However, I suppose she'd better have a black silk by her. It always does for church, you know. And now let us go to supper. They are sure to have eaten everything up, but we may find some hot soup. Francois used to make excellent soup once, but he is so agitated about politics at present that I never feel quite certain about him. I do wish General Bonjour would keep quiet. Duchess, I am sure you are tired." "Not at all, dear Gladys," answered the Duchess, waddling towards the door. "I have enjoyed myself immensely, and the chiromantist is most interesting. Flora, where can my tortoiseshell fan be? Oh, thank you, Sir Thomas, so much. And my lace shawl, Flora? Oh, thank you, Sir Thomas. Very kind, I'm sure." And the worthy creature finally managed to get downstairs without dropping her scent bottle more than twice. All this time, Lord Arthur Savile had remained standing by the fireplace, with the same feeling of dread over him, the same sickening sense of coming evil. He smiled sadly at his sister as she swept past him on Lord Plimdale's arm, looking lovely in her pink brocade and pearls, and he hardly heard Lady Windermere when she called to him to follow her. He thought of Sybil Merton, and the idea that anything could come between them made his eyes dim with tears. Looking at him, one would have said that Nemesis had stolen the shield of Pallas and shown him the Gorgon's head. He seemed turned to stone, and his face was like marble in its melancholy. He had lived the delicate and luxurious life of a young man of birth and fortune, a life exquisite in its freedom from sordid care, its beautiful boyish insouciance, and now for the first time he became conscious of the terrible mystery of destiny, of the awful meaning of doom. How mad and monstrous it all seemed! Could it be that written on his hand in characters that he could not read himself, but that another could decipher, was some fearful secret of sin, some blood-red sign of crime? Was there no escape possible? Were we no better than chessmen, moved by an unseen power, vessels the potter fashions at his fancy, for honor or for shame? His reason revolted against it, and yet he felt that some tragedy was hanging over him, and that he had been suddenly called upon to bear an intolerable burden. Actors are so fortunate. They can choose whether they will appear in tragedy or in comedy, whether they will suffer or make merry, laugh or shed tears. But in real life it is different. Most men and women are forced to perform parts for which they have no qualifications. Our Guildensterns play Hamlet for us, and our Hamlets have to jest like Prince Hal. The world is a stage, but the play is badly cast. Suddenly Mr. Podgers entered the room. When he saw Lord Arthur, he started, and his coarse, fat face became a sort of greenish-yellow color. The two men's eyes met, and for a moment there was silence. "The Duchess has left one of her gloves here, Lord Arthur, and has asked me to bring it to her," said Mr. Podgers finally. "Ah, I see it on the sofa. Good evening." "Mr. Podgers, I must insist on your giving me a straightforward answer to a question I am going to put to you." "Another time, Lord Arthur, but the Duchess is anxious. I am afraid I must go." "You shall not go. The Duchess is in no hurry." "Ladies should not be kept waiting, Lord Arthur," said Mr. Podgers with a sickly smile. "The fair sex is apt to be impatient." Lord Arthur's finely chiseled lips curled in petulant disdain. The poor Duchess seemed to him of very little importance at that moment. He walked across the room to where Mr. Podgers was standing and held his hand out. "Tell me what you saw there," he said. "Tell me the truth. I must know it. I am not a child." Mr. Podgers' eyes blinked behind his gold-rimmed spectacles, and he moved uneasily from one foot to the other while his fingers played nervously with a flash watch chain. "What makes you think I saw anything in your hand, Lord Arthur, more than I told you?" "I know you did, and I insist on your telling me what it was. I will pay you. I will give you a check for £100. The green eyes flashed for a moment, and then became dull again. "Guineas?" said Mr. Podgers at last, in a low voice. "Certainly. I will send you a check tomorrow. What is your club?" "I have no club, that is to say, not at present. My address is, but allow me to give you my card." And producing a bit of gilt-edged pasteboard from his waistcoat pocket, Mr. Podgers handed it, with a low bow, to Lord Arthur, who read on it, "Mr. Septimus R. Podgers, professional chiromantist, 103A West Moon Street." "My hours are from 10 to 4, murmured Mr. Podgers mechanically, "and I make a reduction for families." "Be quick," cried Lord Arthur, looking very pale and holding his hand out. Mr. Podgers glanced nervously round and drew the heavy portiere across the door. "It will take a little time, Lord Arthur. You'd better sit down." "Be quick, sir," cried Lord Arthur again, stamping his foot angrily on the polished floor. Mr. Podgers smiled, drew from his breast pocket a small magnifying glass, and wiped it carefully with his handkerchief. "I am quite ready," he said.